All right, great. Well, hello again, everyone. This is Lisa Savouret, and on behalf of the IPED team, I'd like to thank you all for really taking a few minutes out at this extra, extra busy time of year to join us for today's Channel Masters webinar. This is a special session because in addition to our May and October 2017 Channel Masters members, we've extended invitations to Channel Masters alumni, and we're very happy that many of you are joining us today. It's always fun to get the bigger community together, so welcome again to all of you. It's been another exciting year in the channel, a lot of changes taking place, and that always creates excitement, opportunity, and it certainly gives us a lot to consider as we look ahead and develop strategies for the coming year and beyond. So as they say, it's never boring, that's for sure. So there were many different topics that we kind of kicked around to choose from for today's call, but we decided to focus our conversation on the strategic service provider. So today's session will be facilitated by Beth Vani, Mark Williams, and Raleen Oakes, whom you all know, and I have the pleasure of working with every day here at IPED. They've been collaborating on this content to bring you kind of a mixture of new IPED data as well as their observations as a result of many of the conversations that they have with members of both the vendor and the solution provider communities as part of the consulting engagements that they manage throughout the year. So I'm real happy that all three of them are with us here today. So again, today's conversation is the strategic service provider, and we've chosen to address three key areas. Number one, Beth is going to give you a look at the current state of the strategic service provider. Next, Mark will share a few interesting case studies of strategic service providers making kind of big steps in evolving their businesses and how they're going about doing that. And then last but not least, Raleen is going to walk you through IPED's digital transformation and IoT building block framework, really to help illustrate how savvy partners are leveraging their skills and doing some really strategic partnering to drive new opportunities and success. So with that, I'm going to pass things over to Beth Vani, and she will get us started. Okay?
Great, Lisa. Thanks so much. Thanks so much. Let's dive right in. I want to take a little bit of a step back before we look forward. For those of you that may not be familiar with this term, strategic service provider, it's kind of an important model that we established. It's almost 3 years ago. As we looked at our segmentation and profiling work that we do as a consulting and research firm, and you may remember this concept, it's sort of the way we're describing the aspirational business model status of the legacy VAR, the kind of heritage VAR solution provider business model. It doesn't take the place of much more specialized business models like ISV or direct marketer or consultant, but it is the next evolution to that sort of generalist VAR business model with a focus on increasing competency around cloud and managed services and delivering infrastructure and technology as a service, but then also, maybe most importantly, increasingly facing line of business decision makers and architecting solutions with and for those decision makers within their customers. So let's look ahead here for a second, give you a little bit more detail. There are three major dimensions to the model you may remember, and you'll continue to see writing from the editorial side of the company focusing on partners that fit this model and giving examples of how they're going to market. But these are the three major dimensions. They have been since we sort of pioneered this idea. Product mix, which is a function of how much product versus service the company is selling. Services mix, then, within services, breaking that down further between recurring revenue services and project-based or sort of one-time, but are typically professional services. And then the highlighted element there in red is probably the most important, which is the degree to which they are creating solutions for and with business decision-makers that has kind of material business impact. So those are the three dimensions. And what's interesting about this is there's not, when we look back to the last time we really dove deeply into this with our 2016 census, I'm pleased to say that our 2018 census is being developed right now. We have the data, and this is early data from it, so you're getting a bit of a preview. But against these three dimensions, the main message here is that the model is even more firmly established for companies that are evolving their business model in this direction. There's not more of the broader solution provider community that looks like a strategic service provider. It's still about 17% of the total North American population that fits this model and has all these three dimensions. But the people that are in this motion are even more deeply moving in the direction of these three areas. So let's look at these quickly. The first is they need to have at least a third of their revenue coming from services as opposed to product. You can see, you compare 2015 to 2016's census, you know, annual revenue data, they went from 68% in services to 77% in services. So even more indexed around services models. Within the services model, then, that next row, their recurring revenue services are now 47% of their services mix as opposed to fixed project-based services, which, of course, tend to be much more profitable over time and certainly allow the company to scale more effectively than, you know, fixed price professional services engagements. The third dimension there in the red again, this is the sort of secret sauce around strategic customer engagement, building business solutions with and for business decision makers. And our first census, we set the water market had to be at least 20% of engagements. In that data set, it actually was 40% of strategic solution providers' engagements, number of customer engagements, not revenue, came from this kind of strategic value. In this census, we have streamlined the model a little bit, and it's actually up to 65% of customer engagements for this class of partner are coming from this kind of strategic guidance. So deeper movement in each of these three areas towards the goals we had established in the model. Let's move ahead, Lisa. So just a little bit of a deeper dive on the revenue part there on the left with the green pie charts comparing last census to this census. This sort of gives you a little bit more detail on where the services revenue is coming from now that it's 77% of their revenue streams. You can see managed services as a piece of that is now up to nearly half of their revenue. So recurring revenue, managed services delivery is a fundamental way that most of these folks go to market, and you'll see that as evidenced on the right-hand side, which shows primary and secondary business models. So if you just look at the difference between 2015's data and 2016's data around the MSP or a hoster business model, you can see that as a primary business model, it's still over half of this audience. But as a secondary business model now, secondary business model around MSP hosting has almost doubled. In fact, it's more than doubled. Went from 19% in our last census to 43% in this census. So it's a fundamental way these folks go to market, which, of course, reflects in where the revenue is coming from there on the left-hand side. So let's move ahead one more slide, Lisa. Here's the sort of secret sauce dimension that we alluded to just a few slides ago in the model of strategic engagement. We simplified the way we categorize engagements here to make the research easier over time. In four major buckets, you can see it. Kind of the least differentiated or least value based on the left of largely product fulfillment, right? Existing demand, customer knows what they want, and they procure that through a partner. Moving all the way through to an all IT solution, to a business solution sold to IT, or an all business solution on the far right. The far right being sort of the most strategic solutions designed to solve a specific business process issue or automate a new business process element and sold to and with line of business decision makers. Not that IT is not involved. Of course, in most cases they are, but they're not the primary driver. So in this strategic service provider model, the criteria was at least a third of their number of annual customer engagements needed to come from the far to right column, either business solutions sold to IT or all business solutions built and sold to IT. And so as you can see, with that as the watermark, you know, the two of them together, the 65% of their engagements are coming from one or more of those, you know, types of customer engagements, which is pretty significant. It doesn't mean they never do fulfillment or they never sell exclusively to IT. It's just not their primary sales motion or kind of the way they present themselves to their customers. So I think this model will become increasingly important for many of you, I think, as you look at measuring partner impact and enablement programs that you might put forth to continue to evolve them in this direction. So this is the way we categorize it. So let me just show you a couple of examples of how these three dimensions are manifesting themselves in programs. I think we saw a lot of advancement this year in many of your programs around the way you do enablement, engagement, financial incentives, et cetera, that encourage partners' continued evolution in one or more of these dimensions. This is a program that Cisco's had out for about a year. We call it the Lifecycle Advisor Program, and it's supported by a lot of enablement content and a digital management platform and a variety of other tools. But the interesting thing about this effort is it's really all focused on helping partners learn from what Cisco itself is learning as they're moving to becoming an increasingly software and subscription-led company. The customer success or customer lifecycle programming group actually rolls up to Wendy Barr, their senior channel chief. And so as they're learning how to face their customers and evolve how to sell more subscriptions and manage the lifecycle of IT consumption over time, they're teaching their partners how to do that. So they're being extremely explicit with partners about how to hire people to do this job, how to train them, how to compensate them, and even specifically how to do this sort of land, expand, adoption, and renewal sales cycle you can see envisioned here. So there's a moniker that comes with it in their program, but there's a lot of content and tools that help facilitate this entire process for partners. So it wouldn't surprise me over time if you see a requirement somewhere in their gold program, which is the top of their program, to have a formalized practice like this. Go to the next quick example. Another Cisco example is just a very relevant and timely one. They have put a relationship together, and you probably saw this written about CRM, with one of the leading managed services platform companies, ConnectWise, to create a platform that allows hybrid IT services between their own software and their own platforms, combined with Amazon Web Services public offerings, to be managed centrally from a single pane of glass, single billing, single set of management tools, and actually even a built-in customer relationship management system that allows the partner as MSP. And I'll say that they've had it out for about 35, 40 days. It's in pilot still, and they've had more than 1,000 partners sign up to subscribe to and be part of this offering that quickly. So I think they're very pleased about the take-up rate and interest level of this management tool that allows to sort of bridge enterprise networking with public network services. I think you'll see more of offerings like this in the future. Another example about just sort of basic, it's actually not so basic, financial-driven consumption models. This is an example of the current offering from HP Enterprise about consumption-based IT pricing models. So they have two options, flexible capacity, which is custom provisioning. You could scale up and down based on usage, consumption-based financing models, typically for larger, more enterprise-class workloads, and then a fixed flat monthly payment scheme on the right, a subscription model for partners, and you can both resell these and or deliver them in a managed services model if you have the MSP business model. This is not the only example. There's many of these out there, desktop as a service offerings and consumption-based pricing models from many of your companies. This one happens to be getting a lot of attention right now because of the rate of uptake with the partner community. So not forcing the partner to absorb the cost of capital up front, but allowing them to consume as they are selling it in a similar fashion downstream to their customers. And then one more example here around enablement, one from HP Inc. HP Inc. has recently revamped their entire sales training content and the portal that houses it to bring all of their sales training content together in one place, but I think the significant thing about this is that they've overhauled it in a way that you can see the nature of the courses here is much more driven towards helping partners make the transition from selling products and projects to ongoing services and customer life cycle value. And see some of the names of some of the courses here. They piloted this with a large number of partners to have them go through the content, sort of kick the tires, tweak it as appropriate, so the partners are fundamentally involved in the content development itself, and then they trained all their own sales reps on it first before they rolled it out to the market at large. So really a kind of major effort to align the training content with the motion they'd like the partners to be taking, and their own salespeople for that matter, in selling sustained customer value, not products and projects, and appealing to that line of business decision maker. So just a couple of examples here from some of the leading vendors about how they're helping partners move in the direction of strategic value selling, recurring revenue success, and leading with services. So there are just some examples of kind of what your appetite, and I think that what we'll do now is we'll see if there's any thoughts or reactions that my colleagues have here about some of this content, and then we'll move on to Mark. So any thoughts?
I do. And this is Raleigh speaking. So you gave us a little bit like of an overview of all the investments that vendors are making. And so my thought would be if you took DMRs out, so let's take CDW and the others out, but you take a look at the next level of high volume, high transaction type partners that may not be adding a bunch of services or recurring revenue. Is there any thought from the vendors on that set of partners that we tend to think of as our cash cows, even though they're not DMRs, but high end of transactions?
Yeah, that is a quandary for most of the vendors I think we all three of us work with. They are significant to today's revenue streams and placing a lot of technology in companies that may be the future, you know, seed for private cloud or other services-based kind of deployment, but yet they're not involving themselves. So a couple things that I see is that probably the most basic is in many programs now there's a separate volume track and a value track, acknowledging the role of the less services-led partner type, but aligning much of the upside on compensation and training and field teaming and all that to the value-based track. So there's two points of entry to the program. That's kind of the first most basic thing. The second is I see a lot of help, almost in a business development fashion, the vendor is giving to the larger solution providers to help them find more niche or boutique or services-led entities that they can team with and or buy. There's still a lot of acquisition activity and teaming models happening here. In fact, in the census data I referred to earlier that we'll publish here in the first quarter of 2018, the number one response from partners about the service or capability that they team for when they don't have it organically is managed services. So there's a lot of teaming that the vendor is orchestrating and trying to put together there. And then lastly, I'd just say that a lot of the new practice development enablement kind of activities that we see vendors do tend to be pointed at taking one solution or one technology and offering that both in an on-prem kind of variety as well as a managed priority or you know, delivery model and teaching the you know more volume-based players how to do just one as opposed to building you know an enormous cross-portfolio you know service practice or kind of starting with one solution and mentoring them around how to do that effectively. So those are just some of the things that I personally have seen about how vendors involved in helping bigger players like that who need some help to do.
So it just seems that what's important is for all of us, especially on the vendor side, is to acknowledge both of those are phenomenally valuable models. Whether you're a high revenue, high transaction fulfillment model and you're good at what you do, that's a pretty high valued model. You just got to treat them differently in the track, right? That's what I heard you say. But for the folks who are not high transaction, who are solving business problems, which is the bottom line with SSP, it's having the support to help them solve those business problems, which we talked about today. So cool. Thank you.
Hey, Beth, this is Mark. I have one. So I know in the discussion around kind of the strategic service provider, we talk about a number of the partners having to sort of build out more of their strategic guidance model. But on the flip side, we're also talking about the fact that they're trying to drive more of a managed recurring model. So there's a balance there. So So in your experience talking to the vendors and partners, you know, talk a little bit about the balance you see from some of these evolving partners on how they're handling that.
Yeah, I do think it's an interesting balancing act because they're not mutually exclusive. And from what I'm seeing, I'm guessing you both are seeing this as well, that one feeds the other. And so as they're trying to become more scalable in the way they do, like, pre-sales assessments through the professional services offering, they're increasingly using that as almost a loss leader to get the managed services contract. So it's one begets the other, right? So it's not that professional services are bad or managed services are the only thing, right? But the balance between those two is really, I think, what we're seeing more often than not. But with pre-sales consulting being increasingly invested in to understand enough of the architecture to then be able to put the most effective or inclusive kind of managed services long-term, multi-term, multi-year agreement in place. So it's sort of the balance between those two because one, I think at most successful services-led solution providers, one feeds the other. I think the bigger question is what they stop doing in order to be able to have a balance between those two. I think what I've seen a lot is, solution providers just deciding they're getting out of the break fix business or they're going to stop doing residency, staff for hire kind of, less strategic, maybe lower margin kind of services so that they can shift those resources over to, but either managed services or that really strategic kind of business consulting resource.
Yeah, I think the one thing I saw, especially in the profitability study, was the evaluation of the end game. So if it was, it was using the strategic services in order to basically acquire a customer and acquire a managed service opportunity. So they were kind of making the decision that says, if it's just to do professional services, maybe I'm not as interested. But if it's in the, using those services in order to gain like a bigger client and to provide more managed offerings, then they were more interested in that. That was kind of some of the stuff I learned from those interviews.
Yep, absolutely. Okay.
Great. Am I up next?
Actually, before we move on, if you don't mind, Beth, Jane had typed a question into the chat window, and I think it was in conjunction with you taking us through the HP Inc. University slide. If you had any idea of how long it took them to put this together, I'm guessing is the question.
Oh, well, what they said in public sources was over a year in development. I'm guessing it was probably even longer than that in terms of, understanding which courses were most effective, which had the greatest take-up rates, aligning it with their corporate selling strategies. I'm guessing it was probably at least 18 months. So publicly they said over a year.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Great.
All right.
You want to move to the next slide, Lisa?
You got it.
Great. There we go. So here, one of the things I want to spend a little bit of time talking about is, we talk about the strategic service provider. We talk about what that looks like from a revenue and research perspective. One of the things that we've learned is that, until you can bring this to light, sometimes it's hard to kind of understand what people are really doing. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to spend a couple minutes and just kind of talk about what some partners are doing in these areas so that you get an understanding of what's changing. So next slide. What I tried to do is I tried to pick some partners that were actually making strides in each of these areas. You'll notice most of you will notice that the partners that I picked are relatively large partners, and I did that for a reason. I wanted to be able to go out and show you examples of what was happening in each of these areas and not only kind of explain it and give you some information, but also give you an opportunity to go back to look at these partners because there's more information on them, their websites are deeper. So when I talk about this, for a few minutes, you can actually go back and look at their website, look at some of their press releases, and it'll kind of give you a perspective of some of the, in a more detailed view, some of the things that they're doing. So pick three companies for, folks, a company that's making strides and kind of moving much more to the services-based model. We're going to take a look at Optiv. When we talk about services mix, I want to spend some time looking at Logicalis. And the reason I picked them is because they actually are a pretty big partner, and they have been traditionally very focused or, from a revenue perspective, on product resale. over the last 3 or 4 years, I've tried to make significant investments, and I want to show you kind of what has happened there. In the last part, when we talk about the strategic value, we talk about this a lot. We're now going to sell business solutions. How is that going to change? One of the things I want to do is talk about how Worldwide Technologies has actually implemented a complete new approach to innovation, and that is how they've actually been able to significantly change the dynamics of their company and drive their revenue. You'd be surprised at how much, if you're not familiar with Worldwide Technology, about how much revenue they've generated over the last couple of years. So, next. All right, so let me start with Optiv. For those of you that aren't familiar with Optiv, I'm assuming a lot of you are, Optiv basically, it comes from it's a security solution provider, right? So they were born from the merger a couple of years ago of two really big companies in the security space, Fishnet and Accuvant. They basically were combined, and then they were bought by an investment capital company. Over the last year, in the end of 2016, they actually were looking at going public and then actually were bought by a private equity firm. And here's what's interesting. If you look at their product revenues, so today, or actually in 2016, which basically is continuing on, their product to services revenue breakout was 58% products and 42% services, which is actually significantly different than where they were just several years ago. So they basically were in the low 70% in product resale from the combined entities. So they made a very strategic decision that says in order to continue to maintain the margins they were looking at, in order to maintain their market presence and dominance, they basically viewed they had three ways to go about it. Number one was they needed to expand their consulting, managed, and security operational services. So they made, that was a strategic initiative, and they made investments to do that. The other, they actually saw global growth as an opportunity, which is where they were investing in going into new markets, et cetera. And then the third part, I think, which is really important, is they really made a conscientious decision to start to develop more proprietary IP. So instead of just, selling a product and then adding some basic services on top of it, they really started to look at building out complete solution offerings. They're number 25 on the solution provider S&P 500 list. And we've talked about this before when we talk about the SSP. Why are companies going to that? Why are solution providers trying to drive to that? Part of it is around basically the value they achieve from that. So when we did our profitability studies and we talked about the new dynamics and profitability, it was all around value as opposed to just generating margin. So the great thing about what Optiv has done is basically the markets understood that, and many solution providers out there will sell for a multiple of around one and sometimes less than that X of the revenue. Basically, Optiv was sold and took private for basically 2.6 times that. Some of the things that they are doing in terms of how they're succeeding, one is, again, on the services side, they're really trying to drive much more high-value services. So if you look at some of the announcements they made talking about what Beth was talking about in terms of acquisition, they basically acquired a company called Decision Labs as one of the things that they've done. And the whole point of that is to try and expand outside of just purely security services and start to look at security holistically across their entire portfolio. So they're trying to acquire companies that can actually help them deliver those services. So I highly recommend that there's tons of information out there about them, but they've done a really good job of moving from what was traditionally very much a product resale with very specific and very high quality services into much more of a holistic security solution provider, including investing in managed services and managed services opportunities. So that's Optiv. Next. So the one I picked here that I thought was a very interesting perspective is a company called Logicalis. Logicalis, actually, most of you are probably doing business with them to some extent. One of the things that they did, obviously, is try to make some investments in terms of moving more, not just to services, but they started to make a very strategic direction to say, I not only want to invest in services, but I need to invest in managed services to go along with that. As you can see, in 2013, they basically were about 15 to 16% of their revenue was coming from recurring revenue type services. And essentially over about a four-year period, they've basically taken that from 17% up to 22%, which is actually fairly significant. At the same time, they're also, as you can see, just like with Optiv, trying to kind of drop down their services revenue, or excuse me, their product mix, so that they have a higher services mix. Here's what's interesting, though. The way they've gone about it, they have made the decision to invest to some extent in cloud data centers, but even more so in managed service centers. They've made those investments in the U.S. Their services growth overall has actually gone up around 9% in 2017, which is interesting because of the fact that they actually had decline in their overall product sales. So their product sales went down 6%, but their services growth actually went up 10%, and they were actually able to grow their profit. Just to kind of give you an example of some of the things that, they have done in terms of trying to drive this, they fundamentally recognize that it's not just around the selling of the infrastructure or infrastructure services. And they made strategic decisions to basically be able to offer managed offerings on top of other infrastructure or services. As an example, one of the things that they have recently talked about in their annual report is that they were able to went in and sold a deal to about a $29 billion company. And essentially what they did is they resold the IBM SoftLayer services from an infrastructure perspective, but then they're fully managed by Logicalis. So essentially it's a combination of selling the infrastructure, but then also selling the investments on top of it, or their managed services platform on top of it. And also they understand to continue to do that. They're looking at investments in IoT, and then also in terms of BI.
That's what security offering. That's what the finance guy.
Let me pause for a second. Lisa, do you mind, will you be able to mute that one line?
Yeah, I'm trying to isolate it. Bear with me one second.
No worries.
I don't want to mute you in the process.
I can't see
which line was creating the line of noise. All right, seems whoever did corrected itself. Thank you.
Perfect. Okay. So, again, this is the company, you know, essentially they still have a significant amount of their revenue coming from product and services, but the point is, look, they're making these investments. If you go back, their annual reports are available. There's a lot of information on their websites. You can go back and look at in more detail some of the things that they are investing in order to try and drive that mix in a different way. We got the next one. And the last one is probably the hardest one. So this is the hardest one to actually truly get your arms around and truly get an understanding of how to kind of figure out whether they're actually offering these kinds of services in terms of providing strategic value to their customers. So we picked Worldwide Technologies. Again, if you look at the logos in the top there, I suspect most of you will probably see your name up there somewhere. But interestingly enough, kind of in the 2000, well, let me back up a second. For those of you that are not familiar with WWT, WWT is basically, they grew out of being a big VAR. So they were a reseller. That's what they did. Early on, they were in the Fed business. So a lot of their revenue was coming out of the Fed. And in 2009, their revenue was roughly about $2 billion, $2.5 billion. And their margins were okay, but their revenue, as you can kind of see, was just sort of kind of stagnant and flat. And basically, at that time frame, they started to realize that, look, if they're going to truly change the dynamic of their company, they are truly going to have to get into this, what we're calling the strategic service provider model. And their CEO's perspective was, we're going to get there through innovation, which basically means they're going to try and help their customers innovate in order to, you know, through technology, and basically decided to make some very strategic investments in what they call their advanced technology centers. Here's a quote from one of the advisory board members. You know, when they actually made this decision, you know, there wasn't truly an understanding of exactly how this was going to play out. But the CEO truly had an understanding that says, if we're going to actually change our business, we've got to start to help our customers take advantage of technology. So if you look at what's happened from 2009 until the last published information they have was in 2016, the company doubled from 2009 to 2012. They went from $2.5 billion to $5 billion. And then from 2012 to 2016, they essentially doubled again and are now a $9 billion company. So they've literally grown 3x since they've sort of made this decision. Now, all of it isn't tied to that, right? So there's a lot of other things going on. But fundamentally what their view is that they need to be able to do that and address those solutions with customers. Let me show you the next slide really quick. So here's some of the things that they did and how they went about it. For instance, Panera Bread, you guys are familiar with them. They basically had a $42 million project, which they were calling Panera 2.0. And essentially, it wasn't around, let's go buy, this is how much stuff I want to go buy from a technology perspective. They fundamentally were trying to change the way and increase the speed and accuracy of the way they ordered the ordering processes, both in the store and online. So they realized and basically went to Worldwide to help them do that, right? So what they came back with is they used these innovation centers, and Worldwide was basically able to help Panera figure out what's the best way to integrate the mobile apps, point-of-sale kiosks, as well as the entire infrastructure that was required to make that happen. So it wasn't just that I need to buy more technology. It was, here's a business problem I have. How can technology help us solve that? And they basically used WWT to do that. At the end of the day, did they sell a whole bunch of stuff behind it? Absolutely. But the point being is they approach this less from a, you know, hey, what kind of technology you need, and more around, let's talk about where your business issues are and what we can do about it. And then I just liked this one because I was hungry when I found it. So they basically worked with Papa John's and actually have realized that they also need to get into the application development world. So there's some work that we're going to be doing next year to talk a little bit more about this. But they actually acquired a company called Asynchrony, and essentially it's a company that had 250, I think, or 300 employees, and they've doubled that. And fundamentally what they do is they now can build applications for customers, not just do the services and not just implement the technology, but they can actually build and deploy applications for them, which is what they did for Papa John's when they built a pizza application through their Apple TV. So let me pause there. Marlene, Beth, if there's any questions that you guys have, I'll take those and then move on to Beth, to Marlene.
Sure. Mark, they're great examples, and the rate of increase, after they made kind of the philosophic choices were really dramatic. I'm wondering if you think that it's easier for large companies to sort of make this transition and have the capital to shift like this. Do you think, like, becoming a strategic service provider is only going to happen in the short term for the largest partners?
Yeah, it's a great question. So there's kind of a dual-edged sword here, right? So the reality is most of these big partners actually have the greatest risk, because some of these really big partners, and I think you guys know this, still have a pretty high product to services to mix. So making that shift for the big guys actually probably represents a higher risk. But I do agree with you. It's probably less around size, and it's more around, in my opinion, based on kind of the connections that they have with their customers, honestly. So what we learned early on in the cloud world was that the folks that were able to go to their customers and address deployments across whatever solution they had, whether it be on-prem, hybrid, or in the cloud, fundamentally the partners that could go and have those discussions and be able to provide whichever one they needed, those are the ones that tended to be successful. I think it's the same thing here. The folks that are very close to their customers, that truly understand what their customers do and can fulfill that across a broad breadth of technologies, those are the ones I think have the best ability to do that. Because just like the vendor revenue, it's not, yes, it's moving quickly, but it's not, you know, it's not just completely moving from on-prem to cloud. I mean, it's going quickly, but it's not, you know, it's not happening all in one time. So I think it's a balance in terms of which ones can actually succeed. But I do believe that some of the bigger guys, because they can make the investments, they might be able to change quicker, but it's probably also harder for them because just of the history they had in the background. So.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I would say, too, that one of the things we saw in some of the IoT research we did more than 18 months ago, there were partners around $3 million in annual revenue who very much had made these types of decisions and changes, very much look like strategic service providers. And it came from leadership at the top. It was the vision, right, in terms of how people, Mark, to your point, as you said, how they related to their customers and what they were going to sell. And they weren't going in to sell product. They were going in to ask the questions. What are your business processes? What's keeping you up at night? What problems are we here to talk about and what problems are we here to solve? So I'd say that there are absolutely smaller companies making this transition, but these are the best examples because we can all relate to them.
Right. Great.
And Mark, unfortunately, I did mute most of the lines just temporarily because of that background noise.
Okay.
So I just invited anyone that would like to make a question or a comment to do that via the chat window. Leif had a comment, Leif Kepsel, and he indicated that he feels that the vendors have the most risk as going to a services-centric approach drives a narrowing of vendors. So in his opinion, the partner must do this to be operationally successful. So Leif, I hope I did that justice, but that was Leif's comment at this particular time.
Yeah, I agree. So, I mean, this is one of those, we've talked about this a lot, right? This is one of these, you know, market dynamics. This isn't a vendor dynamic. This isn't a partner dynamic. This isn't a customer dynamic. It's a holistically across the board, and I think there's opportunities and risk with everybody. And I know many of the vendors do struggle with this, just like the partners do, is how do we take, you know, a revenue stream and then turn that, you know, a upfront revenue stream and then turn that into and over time, you know, recurring revenue stream without tanking the stock price. Interestingly enough, I've been through this in an organization where we had to actually look at the stock price associated with doing this transition. And ultimately, unless you do it really quickly and just take the hit, and it's one of those things that's kind of hard to make the numbers work unless you have a plan to grow and a plan to mitigate that. So I agree with you.
Yeah. So Mark, on that note, you may have hit some of it in terms of the difficulty and whether only partners can do it, larger partners can do it. But what's the number one thing that you saw keeping partners? What difficulties are they facing keeping them from making this change?
So I'd say there's two that I hear the most, and I know that it's changing over time. Number one is this whole concept of the valley of death. Right, so how do I maintain and keep the lights on, right, while moving to more of a recurring revenue model? Probably the biggest one by far. Some are doing well at it, some of them not so much, but that tends to be one of the biggest issues. The other is around the whole concept of finding the right people, and I don't just mean it's in the sales side, it's in the services side. It's like, how do they switch from being, you know, kind of more around, you know, just selling technology into, hey, let me talk to you about what you're doing in marketing. Let me talk about what you're doing in your vertical. How do they make that change? And just finding the right people that can come in and do that. They're fairly sparse out there, so that's another struggle that they've had.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Good.
Great. Next, I think, Rolene, you're up.
Okay. Well, so what I'm going to try to do, folks, just based on this conversation, is to tie back now Beth's comments around sharing the SSP model that we did several years ago and the update on that, Mark showing you some case studies. I would like to now take our building block framework, because many of you have asked us about IoT and digital transformation, and our last Channel Masters class, we actually shared this model for the very first time. Most of you, therefore, on the phone have not necessarily seen this model. So with the support of our last Channel Masters class, we'll revisit this conversation a little bit and talk a little bit about digital transformation, IoT, and how the SSP is critical. So, Lisa, if I could go forward one slide, what I'd like to do is introduce this four-layer model, and you see it's got digital transformation and IoT on the vertical axis, and then what I'm going to do is draw in the four phases of the model. But before I do, I want to draw your attention to the lower left-hand side of the slide that says security, and security is required within each block. And if there is one thing that we need these days, it's clearly security across all levels of an IT deployment all the way out to the edge. I think Cisco stood up at their partner conference and indicated that, you know, it was like it was not too far away, like 2020 or something like that. There's going to be a shortage of a million security jobs, cybersecurity jobs and security jobs in the IT industry. So we cannot underestimate, and you'll see a little bit later when we talk about partners who team with other partners to make IoT and digital transformation work, the number one thing happening there is security. So number one, I want to draw your attention to that. And then number two, if you move to the upper right-hand corner where it says analytics And the business insight, which is what does the data tell us and what kind of decisions can we make based on the data, and we'll talk about the data and where it comes from, or foresight, which is if this is what the data tells us, what can we predict from the data we collect around digital transformation and IoT? That gives us things like predictive maintenance, right? It's a pretty traditional IoT application. Those analytics, insights and foresights, that's what sells, that's what gets the customer to buy, it's what drives ROI. So when we look at this entire model, if you don't have security or you don't have the right analytics to give you insight and foresight, you're not going to sell. And those were critical things we saw in terms of partners who have been successful. And the number one thing I want to tell you to come back to SSP, every single partner we have looked at over the last 18 to 20 something, 21 months, every single one was a strategic service provider in terms of their business model. We applied that model, and they had a large percentage of their customer relationships, as Mark said, actually, and Beth looked at the indicators, actually solving customer business problems rather than procuring or fulfilling IT. So that's just the background, Lisa. Let's go ahead and build the first piece that basically says, where does this all start? It starts with business process and customer experience. Mark just took you through three case studies that talked about business process, and he talked about Panera and Papa John's Pizza and how they were changing the way orders were done and how the processes were actually transacted in their restaurants and the customer experience. If you went in, how you interfaced with Papa John's or Panera to get your order, that customer experience changed. So this has been going on for the last 7 to 10 years, most often with cloud. Partners have been changing business process and customer experience with cloud, digital marketing, those types of things. But the digital transformation starts to happen when you start using those new wire-based, wireless-type devices and in-house-type devices on the LAN to change that process and to change the customer experience. So that's the first level or layer of digital transformation. On top of that, we're going to build what we would call digital-ready infrastructure. That says if you go beyond the business process and the customer experience and you start to take a look at things like wireless location-based services, you can use the infrastructure to help a customer differentiate themselves in the industry, meaning the partner can do this. The partner can sell that infrastructure. Whether the customer is looking at digital transformation or IoT today or they're preparing for it tomorrow, the infrastructure looks often to have to be upgraded, and that's a security issue, that's a wireless issue, that's a communications issue. And the best example here would be part of what Aruba has been doing with wireless location-based services. If you go to AT&T Stadium in Dallas or another one of these stadiums where you can use your handheld device, I think Beth sent me an example of the Galaxy, I guess the professional soccer group in LA, when you go to the actual stadium, it starts to tell you, guide you how to get to your seat, tells you what food services are available. You may be able to order your food service off that wireless handheld device and have it delivered to your seat. That's using a digital-ready infrastructure with something like wireless location-based services to change the business process, to change the customer experience, but you've now built into the infrastructure to make that happen. And we say that absolutely sits right in the middle of digital transformation, and if there is an RFID or some kind of a device, an edge device at the end, you're moving into IoT. So let's go ahead and build it one more time, Lisa. And the next one says, if you place an edge device, and that edge device then starts to sense or measure or pull other data that wasn't available before and send it to an IoT platform, we now have the ability to solve new business problems that's allowing new data to come into the world. And we're leveraging these edge sensors and the IoT platforms, or in some cases, the IoT platforms have been used by ISVs or other integrators, and they've been wrapped into market-ready solutions that are off-the-shelf, ready to go. The best example of that would be Schneider Smart Building, who has now delivered a market-ready SMB smart building solution to help partners and electrical contractors change old technology in buildings to, you know, smart technology that allows them to save energy and schedule and improve security and those types of things. And then the last layer on top is when we start to put the industrial control systems on top of these layers, and whether they come from Siemens or GE Digital or Bosch or Schneider or anybody else, now we have the ability to start decreasing cost, increasing accuracy, bringing in new capabilities, bringing in new data, and that completes the four layers of the actual overall framework. The reason we use this framework, both with vendors and with partners, is to help partners, number one, understand what their focus is in terms of entering digital transformation or IoT. From a vendor perspective, it helps vendors understand which part of digital transformation or IoT they're actually invested in to better steer their partners. So that's kind of just a high level on the model. Let's go ahead, if we can, Lisa, go forward and take a look at one piece. I talked about edge devices and IoT platforms, which was the third layer. And the one thing I want to tell you is we see, hands down, every partner who is playing in IoT has to end up having IoT platform type skills so they can collect the data, analyze the data, and put some, you know, smarts around it. And the single biggest trend we see is that partners are extending their base. If they came from a Microsoft.NET environment, they end up at the Azure IoT suite. If they were out there, let's say, generally partially .NET, but they could also end up at the AWS IoT suite. If they are Cisco infrastructure providers and they're leveraging all of that networking infrastructure and the Aruba piece for wireless, and let's say the security platform at Cisco, they tend to get to the Cisco Kinetic IoT platform first to extend those pieces to get closer to where the application and the data is. If they're coming from the industrial space, if they're with GE industrial machines, they get to Predix. If they're with Siemens, they get to MindSphere. If they're with Schneider, they get to EcoStruxure. So your legacy skills have a lot to do in terms of dictating which is the first IoT platform you get involved with. And then what we find over time is that you end up with multiple IoT platforms because these are complex systems and it takes lots of different communications and protocols and applications to put them together. And so something like ThingWorks has been very popular from a proof of concept perspective, but it tends to be the next platform that people take their legacy and then they'll add a ThingWorks and then they'll maybe add one more as they need to. So very important trend are these IoT platforms and extending your legacy to get there. And then that legacy, if you can go forward one more, Lisa, is we mentioned a little bit earlier about partnering with partners. Beth talked a little bit about it. In the IoT space, because there are so many skills required, this partnering with partners seems to be absolutely like 98% of the time something that has to happen. And here's an example from a partner, Wachter. They come from the OT side of the house. They were electrical contractors for years. They eventually bought a Cisco partner. They have great wireless networking skills, and they can get pretty close to an end-to-end IoT solution. I'll tell you, they don't get all the way close because they still team up today with Presidio when big data and analytics are required. But they would tell you that partners don't anticipate, right, bringing in all the field resources, and in this case for physical security or access control, because the overhead's costly. Wachter is used to rolling a van. They've got insurance for the fleet. They know the cost, right, of putting people out in the field to place end edge-type devices. But not everybody's prepared to make those investments, especially if you come from the IT side of the house. And as a result, that's where some of the teaming comes from. So, Lisa, if you want to go forward one, I'll just give you a snapshot that shows you it doesn't matter whether we're looking at OT partners or IT partners. Greater than 50% of those partners are teaming every time they sell or are involved in an IoT solution. And if you come from the OT side of the house, they're teaming for edge security skills first. If you're coming from the IT side of the house, they're teaming for vertical access and line of business knowledge and access to those decision makers. And if you see highlighted in yellow, just a couple of different case studies saying, you know, we're teaming for big data, we're teaming for security, we're teaming for data science. They're teaming for this stuff on a regular basis. They can't really do it on their own. One kind of totally unique thing we saw out at Zebra, because Zebra has a whole bunch of bar coding VARs, right, that are product horizontally centric, but they also have an ISV track in their partner program. All their ISVs are vertically oriented, and they're finding that their horizontal VAR VARs are teaming up with the vertical ISVs to put end-to-end solutions together. So very nice overall ecosystem within Zebra to help their partners make that pivot that Mark and Beth were talking about towards business problems. So Lisa, let's go ahead and
the conference has been unmuted.
Let's go ahead and close out on the last slide. So that was an example of just pulling the strategic service provider together and then looking at how people team to actually make it work. So with that, Lisa, we'll go ahead and open it up to anybody who has questions.
Okay, great. I have unmuted the lines. There is still some background noise. I'm sorry. I don't know where that's coming from. I can't isolate it. We can invite anyone that has any questions on any of the material that you've seen to please feel free to ask, and we'll hopefully get the answer. Oh, Janine's asking the question, what does OT stand for, Raleigh?
OT stands for operational technology, and that's anybody who's coming from the mechanical engineering, electrical engineering, you know, smart buildings, all the industrial control systems that support manufacturing, that support oil and gas, oil rigs. So any of those Siemens, Bosch, their channel, they've got huge, huge, well-established channels, and their channel partners tend to be called OT or operational technology channel partners, and then our partners who come from IT are called IT partners, and that's how we tend to tell the difference, but that's where you see the teaming take place. Great question. Thank you so much for asking that, and I apologize for using a term that we hadn't previously identified.
Okay. Thank you, Raleigh. A general question that just came up. I know some of you are having to jump to your next call. We can stay on for those who have another couple of minutes for some last questions. The session is being recorded, and if you'd like, just send me a note, and I'll be sure to make sure that you get the recording link, and if you'd like a copy of the presentation slides, we can certainly get those to you as well. Okay. There were a couple of questions in the chat window. I'm not sure. Raleigh, Mark, Beth, can we just continue through those? Or?
Sure.
Yes.
There were a couple?
Sure.
Okay, let me go ahead and see. Let's see. Beth, this looks like one for you. If the strategic service provider business model is still less than 20% of the average solution provider in most vendor programs, how can we rationalize a big spend on these business model transformation activities?
Yeah, I think that's always the challenge of how far ahead of adoption of anything, a business model, a technology, a service, can you invest until you get critical mass. I would say that there's no magic number. I think it's a function of how accurately you're tracking adoption of these kind of dimensions of the business model, and assuming that you believe us, these three are the most important for partners to move toward, then you know, I think it's really about accuracy of consumptions rather than trying to do big broad-based, business transformation efforts or training programs. There's ways that, you know, you can sort of build content that's more aligned to the profile of the partner that's already kind of inclined to or moving in that direction. So, although I would say that it's probably going to be several years more before we see critical mass of partners moving, you know, across all three of these dimensions into the, you know, our definition of SSP. But even some of the examples I showed you, like with HP, you know, a lot of that content still is very product and solution-centric. They just added all those modules around kind of solution and line of business selling. So it wasn't 100% turnover of all their content. It was additive and available to everyone, but they really kind of pushed it hard at partners that they thought were kind of most at risk. I would encourage you to look at some of the activities that Cisco has where they call it resale transformation. They have a specific initiative pointed at specific legacy partners called resale transformation where they're bringing tools and benchmarking and other practice development activities to the partners who think are maybe most at risk of not making a transition. So, but if you have more specific questions about where to invest here, we'd be happy to have that chat offline.
Okay, great. Thank you. This is a bit of maybe a more general question if any of you want to take a shot at it. But the feedback is this is a great look back at 2017. Are you predicting any big changes in trends for 2018? Anybody want to tackle that one?
This is Raleen. I'll just say this. Some of the things that people ask us about are things like, you know, hey, IoT. And I'll just tell you that whole deal of can we invest when we're not going to make quota on it. Just at the Women of the Channel, I took a quick poll by raise of hands to see how many people, like from a program perspective, how many different companies were investing in IoT, and it was greater than 90%. We've seen the pace, rate and pace of IoT adoption pick up much faster in even the last 6 months. So I would just say, in as much as it's not core to everything we're doing, unless it's your job, for those of you whose entire job is IoT and getting that off the ground, obviously you can feel the momentum. For everybody else, note that we see that picking up. And I don't know about you, Beth and Mark, what other trends you might see?
I see the continuing investment in trying to achieve that SSP model. So you're right, not everybody's going to get there. But you start to look at, you know, investments in application development capabilities and being able to solve business solution types of issues and how they go about that. Acquisitions, right? So, again, like I said, resources tend to be a pretty big problem for folks. So you're going to continue to see the partnering and acquisitions, in my opinion. So I think it's going to be a, you know, continual trend, and the investments are going to continue to ramp up.
Mm-hmm. I would say the same.
Okay, great. Any other questions? I know there are still many of you online. Any other questions for the chat window? I did have to mute the lines again. I apologize. All right, and it looks like we've satisfied the questions at the moment. Naturally, this is a lot of information, so we always invite you to kind of digest it, think about it. If you have any other questions that do come to mind, certainly don't be shy to reach out, and we're happy to answer those via email or to jump on a phone call with you and help you as you kind of work through some of these topics in more detail as you make your plans and strategies for the new year. I will mention before I let you all go that it's kind of the perfect segue. A lot of you have asked us about how you can continue to have access to iPad research, insights, tools, particularly when your Channel Masters membership wraps up. And although we love to get together occasionally for webinars like these, we just really heard the need very clearly, and we're really excited to be announcing a new iPad subscription service in 2018 called Channelinux. So just in a nutshell, subscribers will get data and analysis delivered in a variety of ways, from really in-depth, you know, big pieces of research to some quick hit slides and things like that to help you as you kind of go about your planning and making decisions. We've really just built this based on what we're hearing people are looking for and what they've been asking for, and really doing our best to support you and the work that you do, which is just so important every day. So I'll be sending out a note about this via email. I just wanted to give you a quick intro so you know it's coming your way. And if you would like to learn more about it, just let me know and we can set up time to connect after the holidays. But with that, you've been so generous with your time. We appreciate the extra minutes. As always, it's great to get together with everyone, and we hope that this has been helpful. And until we connect again, we wish everybody a happy, safe holiday. Hopefully you can unplug and enjoy some time off. And we look forward to catching up with all of you again sometime soon. So thanks again, and have a great day.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Happy holidays.
Thank you. Bye-bye.